the things you've heard just a minute ago and other things like them, are those things that are believed by religious fanatics? Are they only believed by people who can't really think very well? Are they the product of stories and legends and myths? Does Christianity and belief in Christianity require you to check your brain at the door, so to speak, when you walk into a church building? Does God exist? And if it does, is He the same God that the Bible presents, that describes, the Bible shows? All those answers and all those answers to all those questions are offered by a discipline that I mentioned to you that's named apologetics. And it has to do with a defense, with a rational defense of the Christian faith. It is a task that the church was given to defend the faith and the beliefs that we have. So it is not an option. I have reasons for that, but we went over those before. I'm not going to do that again. I did say that there's one area where we can start in order to understand and in order to begin to see how this works, and that is natural theology. As opposed to revealed theology, which is based on the Bible, natural theology uses only the revelation of God in nature and in the human mind and consciousness. And when you do that, you can learn certain things about God without appealing to His special revelation. One of the things that I mentioned last time was one of the arguments for the existence of God, because that's where you want to start. If you're going to prove that Christianity is true, or if you're going to show that, you're going to start by showing, number one, that God exists. And you do that through the use of natural theology and arguments from that field. Then you show that Christian theism is true over and above all the other religions by showing that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And then you go on and show other arguments for the truthfulness of Christianity, and you show what and you answer the objections to the Christian faith. But last time I mentioned, and you're going to give me a minute here. Last time I mentioned that one of the arguments for the existence of God is an argument from cosmology. And that is, there are many arguments from cosmology, but one of them is a very simple, easy argument to remember, but it is a very powerful one. And it goes like this. It says that anything that begins to exist has a cause. So there's your first premise. Anything that begins to exist has a cause. The second premise is that the universe began to exist. And then the conclusion which comes from that, and it's a logical conclusion, you can't avoid it. If the first two premises, if the premises are true, then the conclusion is also true, and that is that the universe has a cause. The question is, what is a good argument? A good argument is an argument that, and a sound argument is a good argument if the premises are true. So the first two statements in this case, if they're true and the logic is valid. As I said, logically, it's an airtight argument. If the first two statements are true, the third one, which is the conclusion, is true. You can't avoid it. It's simply a matter of admitting it. So let's take a look quickly at reasons why we might think that those premises are true. Let's look at the first one. Premise one, it says anything that begins to exist has a cause. How do we know this? Now, again, I'm just going to give you a brief overview of these things. There's a lot more to it. We're just flying over it really fast. We know this because of our intuition. We know from intuition that something cannot come into being from nothing. It would be worse than magic, actually, to suggest that something can pop into existence out of nothing. It's worse than magic because at least with magic you have the magician and a hat, and then he pulls the rabbit out of the hat. But here you're talking about something coming out of nothing. So if you deny premise one, you have to think that the universe just popped into existence at some point in the past for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And nobody believes that when it comes to other things. Yet, in order to avoid the conclusion of the argument, people have to deny this argument. And even a brilliant philosopher who's an atheist, Quentin Smith, and he's a professor at Western Michigan University, said that the universe came by nothing, from nothing, and for nothing. Now, this is an unbelievable leap of faith that someone has to take in order to believe such a thing. The first premise is confirmed also in our experience, and it's also confirmed by science. It is a premise that's always, it is constantly verified, and it is never falsified. Nothing comes from nothing. We see, we never see things come out of nothing in daily life and in science. Now, there's an objection that sometimes is brought to this first premise, and they say, well, if everything has a cause, then, or everything has a beginning and a cause, what's the cause of God? What made God? People who say that simply don't listen, don't pay attention, don't understand the argument. The argument does not bring into God into the picture. It simply says that anything that begins to exist, and God is believed to be a beginningless entity, therefore, there's no reason to talk about God when we talk about this first premise. Anything that begins to exist has to have a cause. So we have good reasons to believe that that premise is true. But what about premise two? What do we think, what can we say, what can be said about that? And it says that the universe began to exist. There are philosophical arguments for believing this, and there are scientific reasons to believe this. One of the philosophical arguments, which I'm just going to mention, is that it is impossible for an actual infinite number of things to exist. It is simply impossible. Philosophers of science and mathematicians believe that an actual infinite cannot exist. There's a distinction between a potential infinite that's good and useful to talk about and it makes sense, but in actuality, you cannot have an infinite number of objects or of events. There's a lot more to say to this. It takes a lot of time to go into the details. There are other philosophical arguments for this as well. But in recent decades, we have scientific arguments to also support this premise, the second premise. And they are, I'm just going to give you two. One of them is from the expansion of the universe. The universe is expanding. And the second one is from the thermodynamics of the universe. I'm not going to talk about the second, I'm only going to talk about the first one a little bit. And that's the expansion of the universe. The universe is in a state of expansion, and before the 1920s, scientists assumed that the universe was stationary and eternal. But through scientific study, research, and discoveries, they began to change their minds. And galaxies, stars, and planets are believed and are known now actually to be moving away from each other. And this suggests that all matter and energy came into being at a certain point in the finite past. But not only matter and energy, but even time itself and space came into existence at that point. Imagine this, before that point, there in time, there was nothing, no stars, no planets, no galaxies, no time, not even empty space. That's the conclusion of modern day science. In 2003, a team of scientists, and those are leading cosmologists, I'm going to give you their names, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin. They were able to prove that any universe, because there's many theories, scientific theories about the universe, but they were able to show that any universe which has been expanding throughout its history cannot be infinite in the past. but must have a past space-time boundary. So the universe must be eternal. And here's what one of them said. He said, it is said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, and a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With a proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Now, let's move on to the conclusion, which follows logically from the two premises. And it says, as you probably remember by now, that the universe has a cause. Since, as I mentioned, the two premises are true, and the logic is valid, the argument itself is sound, and it is a good argument. If you do a conceptual analysis of this, you will come to the conclusion that the cause of the universe can be described. What sort of cause would be required to bring into existence space, time, matter, energy, and a universe of this size? And this is what you get. You get a personal creator of the universe. So he has to be personal because there's intentionality. So there was an intention between his actions. Who is uncaused, beginningless, changeless, immaterial, timeless, spaceless, and unimaginably powerful. Now, I did all this and we showed all this without appealing to the revelation of God in scriptures. It is simply based on the revelation of God in nature. These are all attributes, by the way, that you will find in any book of theology which theologians apply and attribute to God, and rightly so. So I believe that this is a good argument to use. It is a good argument in favor of the existence of God. And I think that today it's easy to remember. The logic is impeccable, and today it is defended very well, especially particularly by William Lane Craig. And he has answered the objections of philosophers to this argument, and he has even answered some of the more laughable objections that you will find on YouTube. Those objections you find on YouTube sounds like the people who make them are intelligent and well-educated, but in most cases they simply don't understand the rules of logic or the argument itself. Is this argument sufficient? Is this argument sufficient? No. I believe that a cumulative case can be made for Christianity and for the existence of God. And it takes more arguments, which together will be good to show that Christianity is true. But if this still is a good argument, and actually some people are convinced by this argument, why doesn't everybody believe? Why are not all people convinced? Well, it's because believing ultimately is a matter of the will. Somebody said that people believe what they believe because they want to believe it. So if somebody doesn't want to believe in God, it doesn't matter how much evidence they will have or they'll get. They will never accept the evidence. In Romans chapter 1, I want to close by mentioning those two verses. It says, verses 19 and 20, Paul says, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." And what about you? Where are you? Do you trust and believe in this God? There are good reasons to believe outside the Bible. I told you before that you don't need those arguments to believe in God. You can simply believe on the basis of the witness of the Holy Spirit. But you do have these arguments in case you want to strengthen your faith, and in case you want to show it to others, you want to show to others that what you believe is true and rational. May God help us to continue to focus on these things. Amen.